Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. I'm John Podhoretz. Today is Thursday, January 12, 2017. We're 8 days from the inauguration of Donald Trump. I'm here with Noah Rothman, our assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
We've just closed our February issue, so we're loaded for bear to give you all sorts of information of an exciting nature on late-breaking news that you already know by the time you've probably heard this, which is that the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, Mr. Michael E. Horowitz, has announced a probe into the potentially untoward decisions made by James Comey, the FBI director, in releasing public information on July 5th, October 28th, and November 6th relating to his investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Obviously, on July 5th, he said he was not going to prosecute and then laid out all the reasons that he probably should have prosecuted her sought her indictment. But didn't indict her, but he could have, but he didn't, but he should have, but he didn't. And then, of course, on October 28th, he wrote to Congress saying that they had new information that emails from Hillary Clinton were on the home computer of Clinton aide Huma Abedin's husband, the notorious Anthony Weiner. And then on November 6th, he announced that that investigation had found no classified information on the Weiner Abedin computer, and there we have it. So that is basically what is going to be looked into, as well as three other lesser questions. One about whether or not the Clinton campaign was getting leaks from an assistant attorney general named Peter Kadzik. One, whether the FBI deputy director should have recused himself because his wife was running for office in Virginia and was getting an astounding amount of money from the super PAC run by Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, perhaps the closest political aide to Bill and Hillary Clinton. And then finally, what the hell was going on with a bizarre little Twitter account called FBI Records Vault, which suddenly went hyperactive just around the time that the reopening of the email investigation was going on, and in releasing about 20 different FOIA requests in historical terms, also released some stuff about the Clinton Foundation and about Hillary Clinton herself, as well as information about Donald Trump's father, Fred. And the idea was, how did this happen? Why did it suddenly go active? So the question, of course, that's being debated is, what on earth is going on here? It is 8 days until there's a new administration. The Inspector General is a political position, meaning that he is hired by the president, can be fired by the president or the attorney general, and his replacement has to be confirmed by the Senate. So while it's often the case that certain positions are people are allowed to stay in their positions until their successors are confirmed, that is not entirely the case often with highly sensitive positions, sometimes like the Inspector General. So this guy Horowitz could maybe assume that he is out the door on January 20th. So what is he doing making a major public announcement of an investigation on the 12th of January? God only knows. Noah has a very, I would say, Boy Scoutish opinion of what might be going on in Michael Horowitz's office. Noah, please.
Well, it's a response to your opinion, so you perhaps might want to elaborate on what.
Well, I don't want to just eat up all the airtime here. So my opinion is that there's something fishy here, that you don't announce major investigations when you're not going to be able to carry them out, and there's a holiday weekend coming, so it's not like they can cram a lot of work into the 3 days. There are only like 5 working days left until the inauguration as it happens. 4 working days, actually. So there's Friday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and the inauguration is on Friday, which is not a working day for the federal government. So there are 4 days in which he can do and complete this investigation, possibly until he is asked to depart his office. So you might think that maybe he's just simply establishing a marker casting a shadow that will never be lifted because they're going to announce his investigation. He'll be out. The Sessions will cancel it because he doesn't want to, the new attorney general, because he doesn't want to go through all of this. And then it'll be, you see, the Trump people, they killed the investigation that might have proved that James Comey was influenced or was trying to get Trump elected or was trying to hurt Hillary or whatever. So that's, I don't know. I don't know anything about Michael Horowitz except I looked him up. He was never in government really until 2013. He was a partner at a firm in Washington. And no, that's not Michael Horowitz. That's somebody else. I'm sorry. Michael Horowitz has been in government. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
He's the executive producer of Arrested Development.
There are many Michael Horowitzes I know one who works at the Hudson
Institute. Mitch Horowitz.
That's Mitch Hurwitz.
Hurwitz.
Anyway, forget it. It doesn't matter who he is. It's just a weird thing, is all I'm saying, to announce an investigation like this. You know, basically a few days before you leave office. That's all I'm saying.
You called them lesser suggestions that there would be other investigations into things that the DOJ did or members of the DOJ did that were untoward involving aid for Hillary Clinton. I don't know whether or not they're going to be lesser in the event that the DOJ doesn't give up on these investigations in the Sessions era. They include the notion that a member of the Department of Justice gave information to Hillary Clinton's campaign in an untoward fashion. And they also include, as you suggested, that the James Comey's number two should have recused himself from the investigation in Hillary Clinton, considering that his wife was running for a Virginia legislative seat, received almost $500,000 from Terry McAuliffe's super PAC, who is also under FBI investigation, which is also going to continue under the Sessions era. So if this continues and the Trump stuff is dropped, which I agree is probably going to happen, that doesn't seem to suggest that we're going to have a real, you know, garment-rending moment over whether or not this IG was being political when he put this out.
It doesn't
matter. The preceding IG. Secondly, the idea that this is going to put a cloud of judgment over Donald Trump, maybe, but for how long? I mean, if we're talking a kitchen sink strategy, sure. But what the focus has been on when it comes to delegitimizing this president, and I agree that there's an effort to rob this president of legitimacy, has been the Russia stuff. And that's going to stick around because there's going to be new developments. There's going to be new interactions with the Russian government, new interactions overseas, events that happen overseas that keep that in the news, whereas this, I think, is going to fade. So just the notion that this is going to be a bigger deal than I think
we're making it out to be is dubious. Okay, first of all, the Inspector General of the Justice Department announcing a probe into the FBI director is a way bigger news story than the FBI than the IG, you know, looking into whether or not somebody opened a Twitter account, you know, illicitly, or whether or not somebody's wife was getting campaign funds. IGs don't investigate the major, most important decision made by the FBI director in the last 10 years, without understanding that that's the major piece of news that's going to come from this. And I don't think anything will come from it. I don't think the investigation will end up turning anything up. I think announcing it is what's interesting. It's literally just creating a headline the week before Trump's inauguration about which adds to the narrative plot line that Trump was somehow elected illegitimately because of outside interference either from the Russians or from the FBI. Abe Greenwald?
Here's a third possibility, not that it's one I necessarily endorse. What if the Justice Department wants a quickie exoneration? They know they're in bad odor, and there will be some sort of conclusion to this within 5 days. There'll be some sort of announcement.
There'd be howling screams of murder from the left.
That would just make them look bad.
Right. Democrats would also freak out about it. It's just a whitewash.
But you don't open a probe and then close it. I mean, you got to interview 5,000 people and let them lawyer up and let them decide whether they want to take the fifth. And there'll be FBI, agents involved. There could be polygraphing.
But Comey's
and all sorts
not
of
going
things.
Anywhere. It would serve the FBI and the Justice Department to keep this investigation open in the Trump era.
It's not going to be up to them. First of all, the FBI isn't doing the investigation. It's the Inspector General's office at the Justice Department. And no administration, I don't care what I don't care whether or not, you know, he said lock her up and everything like that. No administration wants to have a lot of activity going on in its first year relating to the bad behavior of the previous administration. If you actually think about the Obama administration and the deep ideological hunger of many Democrats to pursue legal action against people at the Justice Department who were supposedly involved in torture, and people at the CIA who were supposedly involved in torture and were doing this to limit civil liberties and doing that. And Obama, who actually came out of that wing of the party and used that energy in part to get himself elected, did not want it all shoved aside because he doesn't want to focus on the past. You want to focus on the future. It doesn't help to focus on the past, and particularly in Trump's case, it's not going to help to focus on the past if the story is going to be that he was inadvertently or, you know, or willfully by people in the FBI who hated Hillary Clinton helped, you know, along in some weird fashion. I think, for my own part, I think that, you know, Comey should have resigned at some point after this ridiculous announcement that he wasn't indicting and then announcing basically all the terms under which he could have indicted Hillary Clinton but didn't, and then said nobody would have indicted her, and then all kinds of people that I trust said, that's ridiculous. Everything that he said meant that she was very indictable, and seven other people have been indicted and gone to jail during the Obama administration for doing things that were less significant in relation to the handling of classified information than Hillary Clinton did with the Homebrew server. And his decision to do both those things at once, in other words, to say she was not going to be indicted, which is a legitimate thing for the guy to say about the, you know, candidate of one major party, but then to then cast this giant shadow over her afterwards to create the conditions under which she had to run with the knowledge that, you know, it was like a close one thing. I can't be sure I wasn't going to indict her. And then we all know, I mean, basically the line, the thing that most liberals now believe, and I don't know, but I mean, based on research and 538 and all this, you know, deep unpacking of the polling and the numbers after October 28th, is that the second Comey revelation cost her the election. They certainly believe it. Brian Fallon, her spokesman, who was, interestingly enough, the Department of Justice spokesman before he went to the Clinton campaign, said this is what cost her the election. She said it a week after Comey cost her the election. So bringing it up again, you know, Comey's behavior, if Comey's behavior had a material effect on the election, in the end, it's all her fault. She set up the private server. She lied about it. She told fibs about it after it started coming out. She thought no one was ever going to find out about it. It only was found out about inadvertently because of the Benghazi investigation. But it's still her fault.
That's exactly right. This is going to live in the imaginations of Democrats, but no one else. It's like John McCain suspending
Democrats are a lot of people.
It's John McCain suspending his campaign to take credit for the financial crisis. It wasn't his suspension of his campaign, though that was a boneheaded move, that cost him the election. It was the financial crisis, among other things, that cost him the election. It was the underlying factors, and it had nothing to do with this event or that event, which we tend to overestimate.
I think it is very important for people to remember when we talk about Hillary Clinton. This may be the last time that we really talk about Hillary Clinton in this regard. When Hillary Clinton left office at the beginning of January 2013, she had a 63% approval rating. The decline in her approval rating into negative territory over the course of the next 2.5 years was entirely the result of her own actions. Nobody was really attacking her that much. The Benghazi hearings didn't really get at her. Yada, 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 yada. She did all this stuff that hurt her, including the discovery of the server, but also the stuff she said when she released her book Hard Choices about how she was dead broke and they were so poor. And, you know, her the tin ear, the lack of ability to connect to people, you know, the sense that she was just a corporatist shill. All of that was her own doing. She didn't have to take money from Goldman Sachs. She handed Bernie Sanders the issue that he beat her up with for 9 months because she gave 3 speeches to Goldman Sachs. What did she need to give speeches to Goldman Sachs for? What did she need $750,000 for? Her husband was already worth $115 million. Like, everything that you see is Hillary Clinton shooting herself in the foot, you know, doing things to herself that, you know, Trump certainly himself did not do. So in that sense, she is, of course, entirely to blame. That said, we're in a week in which, you know, we have a presidency about to start, and the president-elect is just swimming in a sea of controversy, like unending and even accelerating controversy. That's like a new thing.
Well, but I mean, if it's extraordinary, if this investigation is yet another effort to delegitimize his election, look at how many different ways they've come at this since he's been elected. There was the recount business. There was attacking the Electoral College. Then there was the blaming his election on fake news. Then they were saying that Russia hacked the election. Then there was, of course, the BuzzFeed dossier dump, and now this. The saying is, if you come at the king, don't miss. They've missed him 5 or 6 times now. I think they're hurting themselves. I mean, I think it's,
are they missing, or is it death by 1,000 cuts?
Ah, see, that's what we don't know. Right. And that's actually, Noah, I think you hit the nail firmly on the head. Trump comes in as a minority president, 46% of the national vote. Remember, Hillary got 2% more than he did, even though she lost by, I don't know how many electoral votes it was now, 70 or something like that. He will be sworn in as the first person since the advent of modern polling to be underwater in favorability as the president of the United States. I think that you can look at it as delegitimization. You can just simply look at it as a weakening, as an effort to just keep him as, you know, as weak as they possibly can, has been reasonably successful. I mean, if you think about it, imagine that 3 Senate elections had gone another way. Imagine that Ron Johnson hadn't won in Wisconsin. Imagine that Pat Toomey hadn't pulled it out in Pennsylvania. Imagine that Richard Burr hadn't pulled it out in North Carolina, and the balance of the Senate was actually the other way around, right? It was 51-49. These last 2 months, what would be going on now would be no candidate would be getting would be approved. We've been watching these confirmation hearings this week. Everybody would be voted down because Trump was illegitimate. I mean, institutionally, he has been saved by the strength of his own party, which isn't really his party, as we know, and is a party that he ran as an insurgent against its establishment. The establishment is saving him. He is being saved institutionally because he can get his nominees through. They're apparently going to repeal Obamacare in the first couple of weeks. You know, he may be the weakest link, even though Republicans are afraid of him. It's their institutional strength that is going to carry him through here, and he is the one who let anything go wrong, and he starts being an anchor on them. Like, they're afraid of him. He's popular with the base, or, you know, a lot of them are from states where he really performed very well, and so they're really afraid of him. But, you know, if the economy doesn't turn around, if some of these Russia scandals really get teeth in them, you know, he goes from being this guy who is more institutionally powerful, you know, as institutionally powerful, if not more so, than Obama in 2009, to a guy who was like a lead weight on his own party. So if you're a Democrat, you want to throw as much stuff in that kitchen sink as you possibly can.
I think there's a price to pay, though. I mean, I think he's being helped by their hysterical edge.
But only with Republicans.
Yeah.
Only with Republicans. Now, that's big. Republicans, he wants, you know, he needs, the firmer and more solidified he can have the Republican Party behind him, obviously the better off he's going to be, right? Because he will command the fealty of Republican elected officials in Washington, which he needs, and he will have a base, which he had, you know, which we don't really know what his base is, and he doesn't really know what it is. He thinks it's this, you know, group of non-college educated, you know, white guys, but he needs a broader base than that.
Well, it's also the talk radio crowd. That they're, right. I mean, if you listen to the AM talkers, they are 110% full scale
Fox News
whatever,
and all of that.
Whatever right. happens out of the Trump administration, yeah. and they're really easy to accept the premise that Republicans in Congress are the bad guys.
Right.
So in the event
right.
that
so
this relationship sours,
right. So today we have Rush Limbaugh attacking John McCain and Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio had this really quite phenomenal hostile exchange with State Department, Secretary of State designate Rex Tillerson yesterday, in which he was asking Tillerson very pointed human rights and war crimes questions, and Tillerson was startlingly unprepared as to how to answer them, and didn't know how he wanted to answer them, and Rubio just went at him, and of course now Rubio is going to be treated like he is some kind of a monster by the talk radio crowd, even though what he was doing was trying to get the new Secretary of State on the record saying that, we don't like all these people who are, helping to create mass murder in Syria. Don't you agree? Don't you think we should be sanctioning people who are committing genocide?
And this is all trite partisanship, obviously, because no one's going after Rex Tillerson, nobody on the radio is going after Rex Tillerson for saying that he believes that Russia was behind these hacks, for example, for saying that, for General Mattis, for saying that we need to confront Russia, that Russia is going to be a problem, that there are fewer areas for cooperation than existed yesterday, for Pompeo, for suggesting, as
Mike Pompeo,
for
who's
Mike
the
Pompeo,
CIA director designate,
who is also suggesting that Marco Rubio is right, that there were crimes against humanity committed in Syria and Aleppo in particular, among other various crimes that the Russian government has committed. No one's going after these people for sounding like they're part of a normal Republican administration and not a Trumpian Republican administration. They're going after – there's sort of the figures who they're comfortable going after, Marco Rubio and John McCain, the Republican base is primed – to be suspicious of these people over the immigration issue.
Right. Now
we litigated that over the course of the primaries right. for months, and now it's going
to
be
important to
Trump
say
frustration.
Right. Now it is important to say it's interesting watching Rubio because and McCain to some extent because of course they were both reelected in November, and Rubio wasn't going to run for Senate again, and it was impressed on him the need to do so that Florida could stay in Republican hands, and so he is one of the reasons that Republicans have the majority, still maintain the majority in the Senate, and he is clearly establishing the idea that he is willing to be an internal critic in the Republican Party of the Trump administration's foreign policy, and very vocal because he doesn't have to face voters for 6 years, and because for all one knows he's establishing the precedent for being the guy who takes him down if Trump has to be taken down. And McCain's 80 years old. This is probably his last term. And he doesn't like Trump either. And he doesn't, he doesn't need, he doesn't care. Like, he doesn't care if Rush Limbaugh doesn't like him. It means nothing to him now. Got 6 more years and he'll be 86 years old, and he can just spend the entire time like Barry Goldwater did in his last term, just thumbing his nose at Republicans if necessary. And that's his seat. That's the Goldwater seat that he is currently sitting in, actually. So this would be a firm 36-year tradition.
Which is fun because this administration likes to compare itself to Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, well, apparently likes to compare itself to Nelson Rockefeller in the idea that Nelson Rockefeller didn't have to, wasn't investigated for conflicts of interest when, in fact, when he was appointed as Gerald Ford's vice presidential pick, he was indeed investigated for his wealth. But of course, that was when the Senate was Democratic. So,
I suspect that Rush and whomever else is going to continue to go after people like Rubio, because Donald Trump is not going to treat this, not going to treat this sort of rift like a normal partisan disagreement. I mean, he's speaks in uncivil terms about other Republicans.
He did
still
yesterday,
right.
He did yesterday at his press conference. Somebody had said something about Lindsey Graham, and he said something insulting about Lindsey Graham.
He said, Lindsey, he's still at it?
He's still at it? Yeah, maybe he'll get that 1% sometime. Right, right. Oh, I could tell you about Lindsey Graham, like that. I mean, yeah, he doesn't see everything with him as a, you know, it's basically a one-way street, which is fine. Lindsey Graham doesn't, you know, he should dislike Lindsey Graham. I see no reason why Trump shouldn't dislike Lindsey Graham, who said terrible things about Trump. But, you know, magnanimity and rising above things and working as a leader to unite his own party, that's not his way. His way will be sort of fear and aggression. And if, you know, and if people like McCain and Rubio don't, you know, decide that they're inoculated from it, they'll do whatever they want.
Trump's base doesn't matter in this. I mean, they're always going to be there. There's no condition by which those people are going to go away.
But I'm not talking about those people. So the question about Trump and what going back to Abe saying that this helps him is the BuzzFeed dossier released by BuzzFeed that says we're releasing a 35-page series of allegations involving Trump, some of them of a highly disgusting manner, that we have literally no idea as to the truth or falsity of anything in here. We have checked nothing in here, but we're putting it out because it's under discussion. Which I've written in the last couple of days extensively about why I think this is kind of a crossing of a Rubicon or crossing the River Styx into Hades for the media, because it's a sort of point of no return when it becomes legitimate to publish things that you don't know to be true and say, well, I don't know if it's true, but people are talking about it, so here it is. That's a new standard. That is not an old, that is not sort of like, eh, everybody does it. That's new. Trust me. You may think the media is bad. If you think the media are bad now, if this standard holds, things are going to happen the likes of which we have never seen in our lifetimes. And the fact that Trump is the first recipient of this will, I think, naturally incline Republicans who are even discomfited with him to rally to his defense on the grounds that there's nothing this guy will do that they will not throw boulders at his head.
Well, but, I mean, I also think it's – but bold. I mean, I think it's like birtherism. Did birtherism help Obama? I think it did, because I think it took all legitimate opposition to him and painted it as crazy.
But in the end, Barack Obama could prove that he was born in the United States. He could produce a document that says, I was born in the United States, all of which was already out there in the form of, you know, publicly reported stuff. But he had the birth certificate. Where's Donald Trump's proof that his advisors were not meeting with Kremlin officials? Well, you can't prove. He can't disprove that there have been.
Okay,
you have the likes of Carter Page, who was an advisor to the Trump campaign. You have the likes of Paul Manafort, who was a campaign manager, who has active links to the Kremlin and worked with members of the Yanukovych administration, the ousted president of the Ukraine. The idea that this campaign wasn't penetrated by the Kremlin is kind of laughable.
Okay, A, just, you know, the notion I'm being put in this position. A, Carter Page was on that list of 25 people who were, you know, Trump's foreign policy advisors. He never met with any of them. He doesn't know who Carter Page is. And Carter Page had no influence on the campaign, as far as anybody can tell. And
Donald Trump personally referenced Carter Page by name, by voice, in a press conference.
He was reading the document. It was a piece of paper in front of him. He said, we have Carter Page. He doesn't know who Carter Page is. And Manafort was fired, and Carter Page was yelled at because he took some meeting that we already know that he was publicly upbraided by the campaign for taking some meeting that he wasn't supposed to take that hit the press.
He was fired because he was under investigation for taking black funds from the Yanukovych
regime. I know. Who? Manafort. Right. Well, that's not the only reason he was fired.
He was fired because that became public.
I think he was fired because he was doing a lousy job, among other things. It occurred within
48 hours of the job. I mean, it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Anyway, so the standard that you have then is that Trump, you could simply make the case that Trump was gullible and hired people who, you know, who were dirty, you know, or had people around him who were dirty in this way. And because he himself has some bias toward wanting to make nice with Putin, people who came and said, you know, I really think that's great what you're doing. I mean, that's a real opening for America today. And he's like, yeah, that's why I like you, Paul. Not only do you live in Trump Tower and have a big professional resume, but you agree with me on this very important thing. You know,
so. But you yourself have said that it is conspicuous to the extent that which this man who fancies himself a deal maker is married to this position in which rapprochement with Russia is the highest priority he has in foreign policy.
But I think that the suspiciousness of that gets watered down every time the opposition produces some sort of, you know, some nothing burger of a report or you know, because you start out think so certain that there's a there, and they've whiffed every time.
Here's my concern. Okay, I have worked since 1985 and 1986 editing things that have come out from former intelligence agents who are now journalists. And I swear to you, from Insight Magazine to the Weekly Standard to the New York Post and even to here, a lot of it is garbage. So much of it is garbage. They are more credulous than you would expect about anything that smacks of a secret conspiratorial allegation. They do not have evidentiary standards that meet the evidentiary standards of normal journalism or indeed anything else. And as people have discovered with the intelligence community, they are often willing to believe things that turn out to be absolutely fanciful, like the famous mobile labs that were creating, you know, WMD driving around on roads in Iraq, which turned out to be a fantasy peddled, sold essentially to British intelligence and then to us by somebody who was getting paid for us for giving them good information. But that's a classic problem with this dossier, which was produced by a former British intelligence agent calling people in the Soviet Union, calling people in Russia, and getting dirt, whatever dirt he could get, and then writing it down on a piece of paper. I've seen those documents. People have submitted them to me as articles. There was a column in Inside Magazine called Intelligence Report that was written by just such a person that was a favorite of my boss then, Arno de Borgrav. And when I edited it, my hair, like my hair on the back of my neck would stand up because I realized that this was all, much of it was crap and that it was very hard to justify. And I would try to cut it back to the extent possible or qualify it to the extent possible because it was absurd.
And it's also a community that has fixations and hobby horses. So if they can peddle a story that proves the thing that they've been on about for 5 years, they will.
Right. Now, that's not to say that I don't believe that there are things in that report or, you know, surrounding that 35-page dossier that aren't true. My guess is that some element of it is true. You just don't know which is true and which is the lie.
I have a guess. Among those allegations in that 35 pages is the idea that Donald Trump would convey to the public that NATO's defense priorities in Eastern Europe, particularly in the Baltics, should be reexamined, whether or not the Baltics like it. And that's exactly what Donald Trump did in an interview with the Washington Post. The quid pro quo doesn't seem to exist.
Yeah,
that's what's weird about
all this. But here's the other problem is we were going through.
And if you're alleging conspiracy, that's where you're going to come up against a problem. If you're suggesting that there's a conspiracy and there has to be a tit-for-tat relationship here, that's where I think you're going to end up defeating your own purpose and confirming for yourself the idea that this couldn't possibly be true because that doesn't exist. You're not going to find anything like that. This is an ideological proclivity. There's not necessarily a quid pro quo relationship.
If it's
here.
An ideological proclivity, then he's not an agent of influence of the Kremlin.
Right.
If it's
Why
his
not?
Own, because
that's what he believes.
Because he believes in it.
That's what agents of influence are.
No, agents of influence are people who
they're
are
recruited and they genuinely believe what they're doing. They're
no, not,
there is no quid pro quo relationship here. Yes, there is.
What are you talking about? Agents of influence knowingly often peddle false information on the grounds that it helps the cause.
Precisely.
Yeah, they're propagandists or, you know, something like that. And sometimes they are paid, by the way, as, for example, you know, I.F. Stone was. As we now know, but an agent of influence. In other words, Trump doesn't need the Kremlin to tell him that you know he's not going to defend the Baltics if Article 5 comes up. He can come up with that on his own. So there's no role that the Kremlin is playing unless there's a quid pro quo. You know, unless he's saying it because he wants something out of them and they're going to give it to him. That's why it matters. Like. If he's got bad ideas about Russia, he's got bad ideas about Russia, period. You know, we think he has terrible ideas about Russia, and he's very committed to them. The only problem with it is if he's getting something in exchange for promulgating those bad ideas, which he might not otherwise have. That's where, you know, that's where the, you know, where the evil would be in it, as opposed to the misguided, stupid, irrational, self-defeating part, which is the policy that he is apparently, you know, he's intent on pursuing, though every single nominee of his in the realm of foreign policy seems to be opposed to it. Tillerson.
Nominee. Yeah,
with nominee, Tillerson, Pompeo, and Mattis.
With the notable exception of his NSA director.
Right, okay, fine. But apparently even he has been talking tougher in recent days at this event that he appeared at on Monday where he said nice things about Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright after saying lock her up to Hillary Clinton. Apparently was very gracious. So they're much more the actual people who are going to be running the Cabinet Department sound much more conventionally Republican, including Rex Tillerson, who, by the way, there's a misunderstanding going on here among some of the hawkish friends of ours who were horrified that he didn't agree with Senator Rubio that, you know, sanctions should be extended on Russia and that personal sanctions and Congress shouldn't vote on sanctions and all that. Secretaries of State never like sanctions. The State Department hates sanctions. Sanctions box them in. They don't give them any negotiating room. They don't like sanctions. They decide after the fact if they work, like Obama, who hated the Iran sanctions. He decided, oh, the Iran I wanted them. That you can't say that the Iran deal's a bad idea. Why, I was great about the sanctions. He tried to block those sanctions like crazy. Administrations don't like sanctions, and when Rex Tillerson said he wasn't sure he wanted to use sanctions, that was actually a very conventional expression of foggy bottom opinion that I don't happen to agree with, but it happens to be certainly within the total realm of the possible. George Shultz didn't like sanctions, and, you know, Colin Powell didn't like sanctions. People don't like
them. ExxonMobil didn't like sanctions.
No. Yeah, but ExxonMobil...
ExxonMobil lost a lot of money in the Sakhalin Islands development with Russia. And this guy's friend, very close friend, who happens to be the head of Rosneft.
Well, that's why he doesn't like sanctions.
Personal relationships. Because this guy is an outsider. He's not a member of the diplomatic cast.
Excuse me. But the same thing applies here that would apply with Trump. That is to say, Rex Tillerson believes, as notoriously was said by Charlie Wilson, the head of General Motors, that what's good for ExxonMobil is good for America. He doesn't think that when he is making deals.
No, he's not. But he's not coming from it from this idea of this lofty I'm just telling diplomatic.
You, it's not lofty or diplomatic at all.
He sanctions box
nobody.
You in.
Nobody who has executive power wants Congress limiting their reach with legislation that gives them sanctions. That's why the Magnitsky Law was opposed by the Obama. They oppose all efforts by Congress to limit congressional field of action, executive field of action. And I'm not defending him because I don't like it. I don't like that the guy who's running ExxonMobil is going to be Secretary of State, as it happens. But that's not my call. And I don't think that what he said was outrageous, is my point. Because if Richard Haass, the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, were the Secretary of State appointee, he would probably say exactly the same thing as it happens.
I would say there's probably a stronger case to be made along those lines of why he would refuse to call Vladimir Putin a war criminal, because you're not going to get an audience that way. The sanctions...
Well, he can't call...
It's hard to say about the sanctions.
No, it's not that hard. It isn't that hard. I mean, he can say, I got to look at it. I'm not going to say in every case that you're going to get sanctions. I don't know who's going to be sanctioned under what circumstances or what conditions, you know, like that. That's the sort of thing that is generally speaking said. And by the way, this was true from the beginning of the sanctions regime of the United States, which was really started by the Jackson-Vanik Amendment in 1974, which denied the Soviet Union most favored nations trading status until it allowed free emigration from Jews for the Soviet Union. And it stood as law until the Soviet Union collapsed. And they hated it. Oh, my God. Kissinger hated it. Nixon hated it. Everybody hated it. Carter hated it. Reagan hated it. They didn't like it because it was a congressional mandate on the executive branch. And they thought it wasn't good policy anyway. They thought it was hardening the hearts of the Soviets, and it didn't give them a bargaining chip if they wanted to try to bargain for exit visas for Jews and stuff like that. So, but that was really the beginning of this. And so it's been forever. I'm a supporter of these things, but this is the way the general balance of power goes. The executive branch doesn't want the Congress telling it that it can't do things. And Congress doesn't like it when the executive branch says that it can't do things. So there we have it. Now, the other big thing that happened this week at the famous Trump news conference was the showing of the giant piles of folders suggesting that, which were probably empty, suggesting that he was turning over control of his company to his sons. And this has now been heralded as a lie, a cheat, a fake, a fraud, a phony, because he isn't really, and he is a total emolument, he's a walking conflict of interest, and America is now a fascist country or a banana republic or something or other because a rich guy who has an extant company that he can't entirely get out of the way of is going to be president. So who's alarmed? Anybody here alarmed? Noah, are you alarmed about the Trump organization?
Well, yeah, I don't know if I have a fully formed opinion on it just yet. The divestment plan, to the extent we know it, is sort of vague. So I don't have an opinion on it just yet. I want to know more about it before I will become fully alarmed.
I will tell you, I had a conversation this weekend with a friend of mine who is from a real estate family, very successful real estate family in New York, whose father died recently. And he and his siblings do not want to take over the family business. And there are others in the family who are running the family business. And so the general idea is that it should be unwound and, you know, basically liquidated. And according to him, because it's a real estate business, this will take between 10 and 20 years. Because there are loans, there are loan guarantees, buildings are collateralized against other buildings. You own part of a building, you own three floors in a building, you own an interest in this, you have an option for that. It's not like stock you can sell. This is the most complex form of ownership known to man, American real estate ownership. And this is somebody who is not a fan of Trump and is not a supporter of Trump, but he, quite the opposite, but he actually said, based on his own personal experience, he had some weird sympathy for this. Trump didn't think he was going to win, so he made no provision and made no plan for this. And in fact, there is no plan that can be made.
I think you can believe that and also be scared in this case.
I think it is scary. Yes. But, you know, his lawyer said yesterday that every solution that everybody could come up with might have worse conflict of interest issues. Like if you sell it at a fire sale, how do you know that the assets that are being purchased aren't being purchased in order to curry favor with him? What are the tax consequences? Like what if he is in a situation in which he is forced to do X, Y, and Z because of taxes, and then he wants to save his kids from excessive amounts of taxes? And, you know, how does he deal with his debt? Problem is that, you know, country's never been in this situation before. He's not a serious politician, so he didn't think that he needed to make provision for this. And there is no real way to make provision for it because there is no such thing as a blind trust for an ongoing business. You can put assets in a blind trust, but not an openly, you know, managed business in a blind trust. Like, nobody owns it. I mean, he owns it. They own it. They own some of it. Half of it's in the pockets of banks. So, yes, he's a walking conflict of interest, and the country elected him. So, as I've said before, the oddity here is that the only disciplinary action that can be taken against him if this goes the wrong way is impeachment. There is no middle ground. There is no middle ground but his essential dismissal and conviction on the grounds that he is violating the Emoluments Clause by the Congress. There's nothing, he cannot be arrested for violating because he does not hold an office according to the Constitution, according to various things that I've been reading. It's not a created office. It's a kind of weird thing where he is the embodiment of the executive branch and the only person in the country who was elected by the entire country, and thus he has a different sort of sovereign existence. Which sounds strange in our democracy because we don't have that, but apparently we do under certain circumstances.
I mean, I think it's a certainty, given what we've already seen, that the call to impeach him, given the first seeming appearance of having done something not kosher is going to be deafening, and it's probably going to happen over and over again.
But that's interesting, because when it's happened, with the exception of Clinton, you know, because of the very specific things that were going on with Clinton and the release of the Starr report, and of course Clinton himself asked for a special prosecutor to investigate Whitewater and these other things. So that was his, he put that into motion, right? The Ken Starr, you know, or whoever became, whoever he had first to then turn into Ken Starr. Most times when Congress talks about impeachment, it's some lunatic who is saying, you know, the president should be impeached because he did X, Y, or this guy, Pete Stark, who was a congressman from California, you know, entered bills of impeachment for every president that he was in Congress for 50 years, and he wanted to impeach every single president, Democrat and Republican, because he was a crazy person. Fortney Pete Stark, as he was known. But here you're going to have a situation in which some of this is going to be arguable. Like, it's not just going to be, he won, so you can't say X, Y, or Z. Like, if there's a deal, and, you know, this idea that he's safe from a bribery charge solely because he won't be doing business abroad. Well, what if he does business here and somebody tries to curry favor with the with the Trump boys?
Well, he's in a no conflict of interest situation, according to him, that the president is immune from conflicts of interest. And it's going to be up to Congress to adjudicate the conflict of interest that will arise as a result of his business interests, which we cannot divest from. And then the Congress is going to defer, because they're Republicans and they want to get tax code reform passed, and they're going to get blamed for it.
Okay, remember,
or God forbid, they do pursue it, or at least pursue it sort of in a slow walked fashion, and then Donald Trump turns on the Republicans, which we said earlier in the show he's perfectly comfortable doing.
Well, that's why I think, my view is, if you're like a Democratic anti-Trump person, you want to keep your powder dry. You don't want to waste – this is where it gets back to your point. You don't want to waste your shot, you know, calling for impeachment every week, even though that may like keep your own people in a frenzy, because there may be a circumstance in which you can totally destroy the Republican Party and put it into a totally – untenable position if something bad happens and they stand behind him while public opinion starts, you know, goes completely haywire, and right. Then they need to get away from him, but his base is holding strong to him, and half of them do and half of them don't. But remember, by the way, in the end, only I think it's 17 Republicans out of the 52 need to vote for impeachment need to vote for removal for him to be removed. It's a 67 votes for impeachment. That's 17 Republicans. Right. Now, that's a lot of Republicans, but it's still less than a third of the caucus, or it's just a third of the caucus.
Right. No, the Democrats...
Looking at it right now, you can't see it happening. But if he ends up at 19% approval rating because he looks like he's a crook, and it's like unambiguous that something crooked has happened, well, then he'll resign, right. Well, that has the same effect, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, they need to accept the fact that no crime has happened yet.
Right.
There's, you know, but they feel as if it has.
Right, but there is no standard. He cannot be arrested for conflict of interest. He cannot be arraigned for conflicts of interest. But there is no definition in the Constitution of what the high crimes and misdemeanors are that Congress, if you call high crimes and misdemeanors, Congress can, in fact, impeach him and convict him for a misdemeanor. He could be convicted, you know, what we would call a parking ticket, you know, or like staying too long at a meter. That's a misdemeanor. That's not a high crime. It literally says, basically using that terminology, that he can be removed from office for any purpose as long as he is seen to have violated some standard. So Congress actually it's only done it twice. Right? There are 45 presidents, and he's 44 presidents. It's only happened twice. But this is an unprecedented situation, and he is going to have to tread carefully. And they are going to have to, if you want to pursue this seriously as a strategy against him, you better keep your powder dry.
But there's also no mechanism for removing a president from office.
There is impeachment and conviction.
How do you get him out of the White House physically? How do you get the commander in chief of the armed forces out of the White House?
No, Noah, that's ridiculous. He would be impeached and convicted by the Congress, and then he is no longer president of the United States. It doesn't matter where he lives. The minute the Congress votes to convict him, has 67 Senate and the House vote to convict him, he's done.
All
he's
I'm saying
out.
Is a lot of this is theoretical and built upon norms and not actual genuine mechanisms. Yes, he's legally no longer president of the United States.
Okay, if you're now presuming that the impeachment and conviction of the president would lead to a situation in which the military would back, then we're done anyway. So I'm saying that impeachment and conviction are thinkable in his case in a way that they have not been that in a different way. Clinton was a very specific kind of case and very weird, and obviously he wasn't convicted because they didn't have the final goods on him other than personal misbehavior. But this is a different situation. I'm not calling for his impeachment. I'm not saying he will be impeached. I'm saying that to say Barack Obama was going to be impeached was kind of crazy, and that George W. Bush was going to be impeached was kind of crazy. But if you say, well, Donald Trump might be impeached, that ain't so crazy. And we don't know what's going to happen in 2018. I know there's all this talk among Republicans about how the map is so good for them and that Senate will stay in Democrat. You don't know that's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen. The whole thing now depends on Trump's performance. Everything depends on Trump's performance. If he performs well, his side will stick with him and the people will like him better. And if things are either if he performs in a mediocre fashion to a bad fashion, he's got very little margin for error, I would say. Very little margin for error. But minority president, 46% of the vote. You know, he'd be impeached tomorrow if they didn't have the House and the Senate, right?
I mean, what's so dangerous for him is that he is a transgressor by nature. That's his thing. That's his appeal. That's what he does. Where does that stop? I mean, if he can't, you know, sort of put the brake on that, then he's going to be in
now,
trouble.
Now, that said, what we saw in that press conference on Wednesday was Obama playing the media like a piano. So it's not like he's playing three-dimensional chess because he's too, you know, he's an improviser and he's just, you know, he's got his own style and it's shooting from the hip and everything. But it's an embarrassment watching them try to, like, go toe-to-toe with him. I mean, Jim Acosta of CNN yelling and screaming about how it's inappropriate for him not to be able to ask a question because Trump said CNN is garbage. He's a reporter. Trump's the president-elect of the United States. He doesn't have to take his stupid question. Like, get a grip. Like, why don't you, like, solidify the Republican base behind Trump? You know, if you could have come up with a strategy to make Republicans like Trump more, that press conference couldn't have gone better for you as a strategist. If you're Kellyanne Conway, it's like, wow, that was fantastic. You know, just keep going. We should have these three times a week because by the time that's done, you know, there isn't a right winger in America who's not going to love this guy. Pretty much.
Yeah. Even though he's essentially retired the term and concept of presidential as an actual descriptor.
Yeah. Right. Well,
because he doesn't
care.
That's
been a long process. Bill Clinton.
It is official.
Bill Clinton manhandling Kathleen Willey and his, you know, in his back room, and Monica with the dress, and everything came out with the Starr report. And then you had this interregnum, right? You had George W. Bush, who, you know, wore a suit in the Oval Office and cried and was respectful and wanted to be this, and then Obama comes in and, as you would say, slow jams the news and goes on television.
But there's always been a desire to fake it, which counts for something.
Yeah.
When you no longer even want to fake it.
Well, it's interesting. He's presidential. Yeah. He'll be presidential in the way that he's presidential, which is to say, it won't mean the dignified, you know, man with the world on his shoulders who is seriously contemplating, you know, the bust of Homer. I mean, it will be, you know, this kind of bizarre, you know, say anything, do anything. You know, it's like, I don't know, is there any analog? I mean, there's Silvio Berlusconi is the obvious analog in Italy, but, you know, I don't know, Gentleman Jimmy Walker, you know, when he was mayor of New York, was like out every night, you know, consorting with prostitutes, you know, and drinking.
And he resigned in disgrace.
He did. And drinking at speakeasies when prohibition was, you know, was a constitutional law. So He did eventually, indeed. But he was, I'm just saying, like, there aren't many, you know, many analogs to this, but he will be, he's the president, so he will be presidential.
But it
and
is,
you know, he'll be President Camacho from Idiocracy. Go see it. You'll see what he's like.
I mean, because that idea is itself an institution that has, you know, bit the dust in 2016.
Okay, so the presidential has bit the dust. Media bit the dust.
Right.
You know, conflict of interest has bit the dust. And now, you know, like announcements of probes into people by outgoing administrations that have 4 days left to work, you know, so the seriousness of an IG's announcement maybe has bit the dust. That's all I'm saying. There's a lot of things that are biting the dust, and more still. And you know, the funny part, of course, is that some of these things that are biting the dust only exist out of entropy. Not, I mean, like being presidential, but I mean, you know, if they don't have a press conference every day, or they don't have a, you know, so who said there should be, you know? That's an artifact. If he doesn't want him, he doesn't have to have him. If he doesn't want John Spicer briefing the press every day, he doesn't have to have it. If he doesn't want the press to have a room at the White House, he doesn't have to give the press a room at the White House.
Hey, there's a great piece at Commentary up now by Andrew Ferguson all about that, about Trump sort of disrupting the Washington way.
Yeah. Right, and that's the Washington way. I mean, the funny part is that every time any of these norms violate, everyone goes, this is not normal. But the problem is that it's all normal. It's not normal to a tiny group of people, you know, who have been catered to for sort of five decades. Probably because most presidents have thought that, you know, all things being equal, it's smarter to, you know, it's smarter to throw the media crumbs and, like, try to figure out a way to get them on, not to be openly hostile, you know, like make it a little easier for them to do what they do, so they can also you can also use them as a transmission vehicle. Well, clearly he is not going to think that the mainstream media is a vehicle by which this administration is going to transmit any information. That is not the way it's going to happen. It will transmit it raw. It will transmit it through Breitbart or, you know, the Daily Caller or I don't know who. And you know, it'll create its own favorites and its own methods, and then of course there's Twitter, so which will obviously be his main means of communication until he decides that it doesn't serve his interests well. And so with that, we come to the end of another Commentary podcast. Commentary magazine in its 72nd year as the premier monthly of intellectual and critical thought. Join us at commentarymagazine.com. You get a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe $19.99 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription. For Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.